welcome everyone to this special edition of Fresh Hope for Mental Health. I'm Brad Hafes, the host, and we're here with Mrs. Kay Warren from Saddleback Church, and we're just glad to have her with us today. She's out in California, and I'm in Nebraska, and hello there, Kay.
Hey, Brad. Nice to talk to you today.
Yeah, it's nice to talk to you and see you from afar, right?
Yeah, we have a little rain today. I'm looking out my window. You guys, are you still frozen?
No. We got a beautiful day here, and yeah, we're enjoying the weather. And I've got all four of my grandchildren are going to be with us tonight, and so we got the kids. We got the kids from Vegas here, and we've got just everybody coming together. And tomorrow we're going through Grandpa and Grandma's stuff in their house because they moved to a 800-foot square apartment. So now everybody gets to go through the doilies and things that they might want.
The treasures they will find.
Yeah. Well, we found some treasures, let me tell you. My sister and I have been a little scared about some of the stuff we found. Mm. So, well, listen, we're really grateful that you're going to spend a little time with us. And I know that the whole thing of mental health is close to your heart. And certainly you guys have really helped us, those of us who suffer from a mental health diagnosis, and helping the church at large really look at the idea that mental illness is real and that there's something that can be done about it, and that those of us who have it can live well in spite of having it. And tell me, where do you think the church is at these days with that as a whole? Do you have a sense?
I feel like there's a new wind blowing through the church. I think that, unfortunately, sometimes it takes very visible the deaths of, you know, some people. I think our son's death, I think the death of Robin Williams, yes. I think that those, as sad as that is, it has allowed some conversations to happen around mental illness. Several other pastors, well-known pastors, have lost their children in the last few years, or they themselves have died. And it's kind of opened up some conversations to people who might not have been as willing to talk about mental illness and what the church can do. So I'm actually quite optimistic about what I think the faith community is expanding and growing and ready to start thinking about.
Yeah, because it makes a big difference when the faith community is willing to partner with the mental health community or the medical community. It just makes a big difference. I know the research shows that those of us who have a mental health diagnosis with faith is involved, we actually do better and we stay better longer.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now, as you guys have had this conference for the last several years, I think you've done two, right? And and the first one you called it the mental health in the church, right? And this last one was called
same name.
Okay, yep. Okay. But you had the focus of the word hope. Right?
Yeah, our website is hope4mentalhealth.com. Because without hope, you know, I mean, you can't live without hope.
Absolutely. None of us can.
No, nobody can.
It's become
these two conferences were designed to reach into the faith community to say that mental illness, you alluded to it in your opening statement, that mental illness is common. It's real and it's treatable. And to get that message out to the faith community, to pastors, priests, I mean, rabbis, everybody, mental illness is a human condition. It doesn't belong to any certain group of people. So anybody in the faith community can make a huge difference when they're willing to start talking about it and address it. So that was the goal of was to equip pastors and church leaders and to bring hope to people who themselves are living with mental illness or their families, and to even talk to mental health professionals who might or might not have a faith of their own, but certainly some of their patients and clients will, and to inform them of how they can bring the faith of their client into the practice. Because as you said, when people have a strong faith, they do better, and they do better longer. So our conference was both pastors, church leaders, people living with mental illness and their families, and to help mental health professionals integrate faith into their practice.
Absolutely. Well, I just know that it's helped the church at large, and I really appreciate what you and Rick have been willing to do as far as really stepping up to the plate and challenging the church. Because for a long time, I think there's been no theology to build. For some reason, we've made the brain something it is not, and that it's spiritual. And
right.
And I always say, my mind is what my brain does, and my brain is no more spiritual than my colon or any other part of my body. And
I mean, I quote you on that.
Yes, you may. and my brain is just as subject to difficulties and brokenness as the rest of my body is. And yet, we understand that about the whole body, except for the brain many times.
Yeah.
And I can't be in my right mind if my brain's not functioning correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about how we're whole people, you know, we're body, mind, and soul, and we need help in every area. I need help in my body, and my brain is part of my body. I need help with my emotions, and I need help with my spirit, you know, the part of me that is spiritual and will last forever and communes with God. And I think there have been some misperceptions along the way in the church. Actually, the church has a pretty tragic history in some ways through the, you know, hundreds of years of treating people with mental illness. I think Jesus' example was such an example of grace and treating people as whole people. And if we look to Jesus and see how he treats people, he treated people who were ill, whether that was with their body or with their spirit or their emotions, then we know how we need to respond. But somewhere along the line, that got a little lost, and it, there was this misperception that if you struggled with a mental illness, that you needed to, that it was all spiritual, and mm-hmm. like you said, and that you could fix it if you memorized more verses or attended more weekly meetings at church or just confessed your sin or had more faith or, you know, it, fill in the blank, any number of things. And that attitude has gone on for a really long time.
It certainly has.
And I think when there was the rise of secular psychology and psychiatry in the late 1800s and into the 20th century, now the 21st, I think people who really were people of faith saw this secular mindset that said that there's nothing to do with the spirit and you know, this has nothing to do with God. And so then they kind of hunkered, so the believers hunkered down over here in their little corner saying, no, it's just the Bible. And the folks over here in the secular, you know, community go, no, it's all science. And that's a false, that's a straw man. That's a false dichotomy that doesn't have to be there. We need good theology and we need good science. And when the two go together, it's clear that we're whole people. And as you said, our brain is another part of our body that can break or
yes.
not function right.
Yeah, and cause all kinds of behaviors that wouldn't necessarily, if somebody was in their right mind, they wouldn't necessarily be behaviors. Now, that doesn't make me not responsible for what
right.
I do when my brain's not working properly. But it certainly, it's not an excuse, but it is a reason. And
right.
Sometimes
I'm going to sneeze. You
oh, can talk. Yeah, sure.
Now that I said that, of course, I don't have to sneeze. It'll
oh, well, I like it. If I could quote you on that, then it will be even Steven, right?
That's my profound comment for the day.
But, you know, I think about people who have severe mental handicaps. You know, their brain does not function. They have learning disabilities, all these kinds of things. Or people with Tourette's syndrome that might say something or bad things come out of their mouths. I've had that in worship where a woman just would say things that were totally inappropriate. But everybody understood, and they had compassion, and they understood their brain didn't function. Yeah. And yet, there could be in the very same row someone else who was experiencing depression or had a manic episode, and people judged them differently. And it was very difficult for me sometimes because it's kind of an blind side that we have, or we're blind.
Don't you think it's a combination of ignorance? You know, people just simply don't know that the brain is an organ and can malfunction. So there's ignorance, and then there's the misperceptions, and then I think that there's sometimes just that stigma, as you said, is so huge. And for years, for about a decade, I was an advocate for people living with HIV and AIDS and for orphans and vulnerable children. And I traveled, you know, all around the globe and sort of got used to people coming up to me and whispering in my ear, you know, I'm HIV positive, or I'm living with AIDS, or I'm dying, or my husband died, or my daughter died, or something. And they whispered it because the stigma is so huge.
Yes.
But what I have been surprised by and did not anticipate is, as now as I've moved into advocacy for people living with mental illness, is that now people whisper in my, they'll come up, they whisper, but now they whisper, I have bipolar disorder, I have an eating disorder, I have schizophrenia, I have borderline personality disorder, I have depression, and they whisper it. Or my father died of suicide 20 years ago, but we still say it was a heart attack because we don't want anybody to know. So people are still whispering to me. And what I really want is to knock down that stigma to the place so that nobody has to whisper anything about their lives at church.
And of all places where we shouldn't need to whisper, I mean, because I envision Jesus saying, why are you whispering?
Yeah.
Because all I know is that my life was made so public that I couldn't whisper about my brokenness. And he showed me, and through all of this, is that his light can't shine through our cracks and our brokenness if we're busy covering it up.
Right.
And then it's all about me instead of about what he could do. I think somebody wrote a book about it not being all about me, but you might know him.
Been the first line of that.
I think you're right. Let's talk just a little bit about hope, just the whole concept of hope. What have you discovered, or what are some of your thoughts in regards to hope in a broad sense, and then hope in the narrow sense of the hope that we have in Christ? I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, where should I start? I think, like I said at the very beginning, we can't live without hope. I mean, we truly cannot live without hope. And yet hope is a bit of a dangerous word, I think. At least it was for my son Matthew and for some of the people that I talked to, because when you live with the mental illness and everybody's trying to fix you and find a solution and make it better, that at least for my son, he would say to me, Mom, how many times are you going to say, this is the doctor? This doctor right here, this is the doctor that's going to make it better.
Or medicine.
This medication right here, this is the medication that's going to be the game changer. This treatment right here, this book, this school program. And he got to the place where he just said, how can I believe in hope anymore when every time you tell me, this is the one, or this is the right thing, this is what we've been looking for, and it isn't. And so hope after a while can have a bit of a dangerous feel, you know, or a very disappointing aspect to it if you keep running into these walls of you're trying and you don't see any progress, you don't see much healing or much recovery or anything else. So while we have to have hope and we're desperate for it, it also has a little bit of a dangerous, if you will, quality to it. And so how to manage a life that has hope and that believes that people can get better, that people can manage, you know, their illness. People can do well and have a sense of well-being and have a family and work and make a meaningful contribution. How to keep that hope alive in the face of sometimes, particularly with severe mental illness, some of the setbacks or some of the things that you try that don't seem to work. So it's a dance. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a dance. And I don't know how people do it without the Lord, because mm-hmm. Sometimes even with the Lord, life is really hard. But if you don't have the Lord and you're facing some of those things that just seem intractable, that don't move and that don't change or that don't get better, how do you keep holding on if you don't have that very rock solid relationship with Christ, and I would say a really strong relationship with other believers? So hope is absolutely pivotal to life and a sense of well-being.
It almost seems as though hope has two sides to it, if you will. And there's the hope that's wishful thinking, or, you know, there's not a sure and certainty right. about it, where we have to say, for those of us who have a diagnosis, I may have a setback. My brain, no matter with me doing all the right things in the world, I may have a setback and it could be difficult. So I'm hopeful that that won't happen, and I'm going to do everything within my power to not do that, right. but it could happen, and I need to be prepared for that. But I always tell people, no matter whether that happens or not, there's this other part of hope, and that's that sure and certain hope that even though my life may fall apart, be absolutely a complete disaster, I may have the worst emotional pain I've ever had in my life, things could be the worst that they've ever been, I will still choose hope based upon my faith in Christ. And I call that Romans 8:28 hope. Even though everything's been blown to smithereens, God can take this, and even out of the muck and mire, wonderful things can come out of it, or good things.
One of the quotes that I read pretty soon after Matthew died was from Eric Little. He was an Olympic runner in the 1924 Munich Olympics. He was the main character in Chariots, the movie Chariots of Fire.
Sure.
And so most people remember that movie Chariots of Fire. And he was a Scottish missionary. And Eric Little says that circumstances may appear to wreck our lives, but God is not helpless among the ruins. Circumstances may appear to wreck our lives and God's plan, but God is not helpless among the ruins.
Absolutely.
And that to me is probably one of the most hopeful quotes I've ever come across, because there have been times, obviously with our son's death, there have been moments in which I have just said, my life is in ruins. It will never be good again. We can't go forward. It's just ruined. These circumstances have wrecked our lives. And I have a few, and I'm sure you know, just from what I know of your story, Brad, there had to be some moments in which you said, my life is completely and utterly ruined.
I could honestly tell you that there were days where I didn't see what purpose there was to go on, because I absolutely knew that the best was behind me and there could be nothing good ahead.
Nothing good. And for this quote then, to which I think dovetails with Romans 8:28, is that circumstances may appear to wreck our lives and God's plan, but God isn't helpless among the ruins. And so in the ruins of your life, God has rebuilt you and your family and given you a ministry different than you ever imagined, and broader and deeper and more beautiful. And in the ruins of our son's death, God is in the process of rebuilding our lives, and I only can see a taste of it. It's just been 3 years, and to me that's like a blink of the eye. But I'm watching God work out his plan of love even in what I would consider ruins. And Ezekiel 36 and 37 have been such beautiful reminders to me of how God says, you know how your city has been leveled and the walls are down and everything is a mess and ruined, and God just says over and over, I am a rebuilder. I will rebuild the walls. There will be cattle on the field, in the fields again. These cities will be populated. What has been ruined, I will rebuild. And so for anybody, for me, for you, for anybody listening, your life may feel like it is in absolute ruins and it's the circumstances wrecked, but God is not helpless in your ruins, and He can and will rebuild.
Absolutely. And now I'm from Nebraska, we have good food, nice people, no God-made lakes, no mountains, no ocean. So we have a football team that we have to depend on to give us entertainment and be social. And usually we hope that they win. And it's wishful thinking hope. It's not sure and certain hope ever.
That's right.
And the last few years have definitely been only wishful
thinking.
Have tested
your hope.
Yes. And we're not even sure we can say that word anymore here. But I always say it's as though they're playing a horrible second and third quarter, but you know that they win, so you watch the game totally different. And I don't think that separates us from our pain in life, but I know how this ends, and I know who wins, and I know that He can take, and sometimes I've taken people and said to them, I want you to know my story in detail so that you understand what God can do in spite of how horrible it all appears to be.
Because, well, and you're pointing out the thing that I think distinguishes what happens for people who are believers in Christ and go through really hard times and those who don't. And that is, we not only have hope for this life, like I said, that God can rebuild the ruins here and bring good out of bad, and that people can recover and that people can manage their life. All of those things, that's hope for here. But we have that hope, the certain hope that you're talking about, is that this isn't the end of the story.
Absolutely.
When my son died, it was not the end of his story, and it's not the end of, I will see him again. Matthew had a faith in Jesus Christ, and he became a Christian when he was a child, and his suicide did not separate him from God's love. I believe the scripture teaches in John 10 that we are in, that Jesus holds us in his hands, and he says there that nobody can pluck themselves, no man can pluck himself. Well, what if I pluck myself out? I'm sorry, you are not strong enough. You take yourself out of the hands of Jesus Christ. So Matthew, who was in the hands of Jesus, is in the embrace of Jesus now. So it's not the end of him. And I know that when I die, I will see Matthew again. And that's the hope I have for myself. Because someday I will die. I could hit my bus. I could have reoccurrence of cancer. I could live to 103 and die of old age. Someday I'm going to die.
Yeah.
And the hope, the certain hope that I have, that this is not the end of me as well. It does frame the way we watch a football game. It does frame the way we live our lives, because we know there's more.
Absolutely.
This is not the end of the story. And that is a hope for both this life and the life that is to come.
Absolutely. And I want to encourage anybody who's watching or listening. There's a group of you right now that are listening to us live, and there'll be many more that listen to us later. Folks, let me tell you, there is hope, sure and certain, in the end. And even if you're in pain, God can still do incredible things with pain. And he can repurpose pain, and he can build you up. One of the good examples of this, Kay, would be that recently we went out to Chicago. We've got a large church out there, Parkview Christian Church in now I'm not going to remember the name of the...
Orland Park.
And my assistant has to tell me where it's at. But in Orland Park, and I was out there, and we were videotaping some folks for the Night of Inspiring Hope, in which you're going to be our keynote speaker here soon. And one of the moms that we videotaped had lost her son to depression. And I refuse to... I think it's terminal sometimes, and it's not a choice. It's death that comes. Like, we don't say people died by choosing cancer,
No, I agree completely.
And so anyway, this mom, I said, you know, Kay Warren is going to be there. What would you like to say to her? And she could barely get the words out. And I don't know if we'll be able to use the clip. I haven't seen it yet. But I want you to know this, that she said, that woman has given me more hope by how she has just hit this head on and hasn't been afraid to talk about it. And that, I really believe hope is something we can give away to each other. I really do. There are times.
And it's contagious.
Yes.
It can be. Can be contagious.
Yep.
Just as depression can be contagious.
Oh, yeah.
So can hope.
Yes. In fact, there's a book by Dr. Shane Lopez. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but it's called Making Hope Happen. And he has researched hope for 14 years. And he works for the National Gallup Poll. And he.
Better write this down.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's an exceptional book. And he'd be a great speaker at your conference because he talks about the fact that he's done this research and he's a psychologist. And what he has found is that people become hopeless when they have lost their future, when they have no future. So it's as simple as having a future creates hope. And hope is absolutely catching, and you can actually borrow it from somebody else. And I think faith, hope, and love operate the same way. You know, we can love somebody and they can feel the love, even though they may feel loveless, it can bring them into a relationship with love. I think the same is true with hope. I think there's a reason those three words are together. But anyway, I want you to know that this mom,
that's really true.
The hope that you have poured into her and the courage for her to become an advocate and going around to schools in the Chicago area talking to teenagers about suicide. And,
yes, I'm really glad.
Yeah.
That's to me the rebuilding and the her life appeared ruined. And yet God is rebuilding and renewing and bringing beauty from the ashes. And believe me, the ashes are real.
Oh, you know, they absolutely
are. The pain and the suffering and the struggle and the grief is real. It's profound. And I would not wish it on anybody. And at the same time, we're in that process of rebuilding hope.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that hope sometimes comes through our tears. We give hope sometimes. And through the very pain that we suffer, it is hope. And it's a... to me, it's so beautiful the way the Lord takes our lives and our brokenness and out of the manure of all of it, rebuilds something new. Better. I've had people come up to me and hug me and, oh, Brad, how are you? You know, and I just want to gag because it's like, I'm great. My life's never been better.
Yeah.
And, you know, but they're so stuck on the brokenness that they can't see what God has done. And, you know, you probably know this about Japanese pottery. When it cracks,
they keep it,
and then they fill it with gold. And it actually...
I just heard that, a month ago.
Oh, yeah.
I guess somebody was showing me a website of this incredible, and super expensive pottery.
Oh, yes.
That they deliberately crack, and then, as you say, fill with gold. And it is works of art.
Absolutely.
And when you think about that with our lives, the lessons are profound.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No doubt about it. Well, I want to kind of ask you a question about how you see what you're doing at Saddleback. Where are you guys headed with your hope? And I know that you've got the hope. I don't know what you call it, the Hope Kit or the Hope Box or whatever. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we have a toolkit called the Hope Toolkit, and it is for pastors, church leaders, anybody who is a little intrigued by this and says, you know, I'd like to make our church a place where people living with mental illness feel safe and welcomed and embraced and can bring their whole selves, you know, to church. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how to do it. I don't even know how to do it. And they think that because Saddleback's this really big church that, of course, we could have a mental health ministry, but, you know, they've got 75 people. What could they possibly do? So we put together this toolkit that has messages from me and Rick about mental illness, because one of the things that every church can do, whether you have 15 people in a home group or 500 or 5,000, is that you can, a pastor can preach a message on mental illness. It doesn't cost any money. It doesn't cost any training. It doesn't take any staff. It's you as a minister standing up there and saying, this is what the Bible says, you know, about God's compassion and care for people living with mental illness. That doesn't cost anything. That's within the reach of everybody.
And pastors, so, pastors, let me say to you, please, 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 please do that. It's the simplest of things. And if you think depression's not in the Bible, then you've not read the book of Psalms.
That's right. Or how about Elijah or Jonah or Paul? You know, Paul said we despaired of life itself. If that's not depression, I don't know what is. But so every pastor can, well, and that's part of what we want to do, because we believe that every pastor is already talking to people who are living with mental illness. The pastor just may not recognize it. So we, rather than this, you know, telling them some other big program they need to start, we just want to equip them to do better what they're already doing. And so to bring some information about mental illness, how common it is, we've got some resources in this toolkit. My wonderful assistant just brought this to me, so it's probably filled with the screen, but it's Hope for Mental Health. And like I said, it's got those messages for pastors. It's got testimony DVDs, because maybe nobody in your church is willing. Like, Brad, you talk about your life all the time. I talk about the fact that I've lived with depression, you know, my whole life, that our son had, you know, a whole host of mental illnesses. But there'll be people who, because of the stigma, aren't ready to do that. So right. there are testimony videos in this toolkit. So, because we want to humanize. We want to put a face and a name to people living with mental illness. And when you see some of these, you'll go, well, goodness. Or people probably say to you, what? You look just like me. You know, mm-hmm. You're just a person. And that's like, yes, that's the point.
Yes.
This is just people. This is just people. In fact, the people you've taught Sunday school next to for the last 15 years, they could have an eating disorder. They could have depression. So the messages, testimonies, we have a whole weekend in there for how to talk to junior high and senior high students. It's got the videos, it's got games, it's got outlines, it's got, you know, the messages. We've got a journey called Journey Toward Hope, which is a book that it's an experiential journal. It's not really a journal, but it's not really, you know, Bible study. It's around this idea that hope, we want a journey toward hope. And it's written for people who are living with mental illness. So written by people living with mental illness, for people living with mental illness. So this toolkit is really, there's more stuff in it, but the point is, it's supposed to give you, I want to do it, but I wouldn't even know how to start, you know, kind of a pathway of how you would create mm-hmm. a mental health ministry in your church. And that's available at saddlebackresources.com. And the pieces can be bought separately, or you can buy the whole toolkit. And, you know, we don't think it's the be-all, do-all of toolkits, but it's just to give people a start.
Well, and I think one of the things that I'm realizing that you guys are doing is you're really, and this is what I appreciate about it, you're not approaching it that you have one end all, be all.
Right.
But you're really helping a church where anywhere from places where people are willing to talk, maybe where places aren't, and you're giving that some real thought, because if you think about that, only 3% of pastors are willing to talk about these things openly or are ready to handle them. What small percentage of Christians are ready to talk about it or to handle it? You know, so that's exceptional.
Well, you know, I was thinking of something else when we were talking about things that every pastor or Bible study teacher or Bible leader, you don't have to be a pastor, but maybe you're leading a Bible study or leading a devotional or a Sunday school class, you know, to talk about it. But something that's also within the grasp of every single person is to pray for people who are living with mental illness. Yep. I will never forget that before I think Matthew even passed away, my husband stood up on a weekend, and he just, in his pastoral prayer, he just said something like, God, we know that there are people sitting here today who are living with mental illness, or their family member is, and they're suffering, and they're struggling, and it's so hard to not be able to talk about it. And he started naming by name different, not people, but diagnoses, you know, people living with depression. Yep. People living with anxiety, people living with schizophrenia, and the people who came up afterwards with tears in their eyes and said, thank you so much for mentioning this in yes. church. So such a simple, tiny thing that you don't need to be equipped to do. Mm-hmm. It's just entering into the pain of other people and voicing it and saying, hey, folks, this is real. It exists, and it's here, and it's us.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And let me tell you, for those of us who have a diagnosis, who have felt the shame of it, and even stigma within ourselves about ourselves and about our diagnosis, the power of somebody doing that, just a pastor just opening that door, can pour hope through you like really fast.
Absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely.
So pastors, think about that. Those of you who, by the way, we have a survey or a poll going on right now for those of you who are watching this live, and I'd encourage you to take that poll. There's 7 questions that we're asking. And let's say you're in a church where there's nothing going on, you're frustrated, you want something to go on. Let me suggest this to you. Think about the fact that if you just are somebody's friend, if you know somebody struggles with depression, for instance, call them and ask if they want to go to a movie or go. Don't talk about their depression. Don't talk about their mental health issue. If they want to, listen, of course. But just be their friend. Because a lot of us who have mental health challenges, we have isolated ourselves to the point where there's another book I just read, and you'll want to read this one too, Kay, if you haven't.
I'm getting ready to write it down.
Outreach Magazine had me review pastoral counseling books, and it's a book called The Soul of Shame.
Mm.
And it is written by a psychiatrist who's a Christian, and he talks about how deeply rooted shame is in our brains. And when we isolate, which is pretty typical whenever you feel a lot of shame, it actually makes your brain less able to think and to be flexible with solutions. And so the best thing you can do for somebody who's isolating because of a mental health issue is be their friend and pull them out of their isolation. And,
absolutely.
You know,
I'll trade books. Go ahead. No, you go ahead, because then I'm going to tell you a book that you just made me think of.
Okay. Because I wanted to isolate. When I was at my worst, I would not even leave my house. I'd have panic attacks. I got agoraphobic. I had a friend fly all the way from Phoenix, Arizona, just to come and take a walk with me. And he begged me. He said, I came all the way. Come outside. And I could only last about 3 blocks. But my wife would say to me, we're going for ice cream today. You don't get to choose whether you're going or not. You're going with me. The only thing you can choose is which Dairy Queen we're going to go to. And I mean, she was...
You're putting her of ice cream, that's it.
Yeah, she hasn't said that to me lately. I really wish she'd take me. But by the way, I've lost 60 pounds since I've been out there.
I can tell. Look at your face. I can tell. Good for you.
Wanted to do is say, when I was out there talking and I could see myself on those huge screens, I wanted to say, oh my gosh, I'm huge. And then I wanted to say, I have bald spots in my head.
Those high definition screens are not kind.
No, that's not for sissies. You have to...
I just have to put it out of my mind.
Yeah.
Well, 2 things that what you said made me think of. A book that I would highly recommend, especially for pastors or church leaders, is called Resurrecting the Person by John Swinton. And that goes back to what you were saying about, you know, if you know somebody's struggling, you know, you don't have to necessarily talk about their illness, just be with them, because the isolation is so profound and the shame. And Swinton talks about that, that what most of us, not most, what every single one of us crave is to be cherished, to be loved, and to be radically accepted and friended. We don't want to be somebody's project. We don't want it, we don't want people trying to fix us. We don't want to know that people are showing interest in us out of a duty that they love us and they want us to be friends. They want to be friends. Yeah. And he talks about how that's what God did with us, that we were going our own way. You know, we didn't have anything in common with God, and yet Romans 5:8 says that he came, and while we were still, you know, in our shame and sin, he friended us. John 15:15, Jesus said, "I call you friends." Mm-hmm. And when I've meditated on that, that has just kind of rocked my world, because when I think that, you know, we talk about friending people, would you friend me on Facebook, would you friend me on, you know, my friend on Twitter or Instagram or whatever, but to know that the God of the universe friended us when we were completely unlikable and not anywhere near him, and that he expects us to do that for each other. I mean, our definition of friendship, Swinton says, particularly in the West, is about this deep. Mm-hmm. It's like based on, oh, you like Nebraska Cornhuskers? I like Nebraska Cornhuskers. Right. Or you seem like a nice guy, so we could maybe be friends. That won't carry you through when life pulls the rug out from underneath you. We've got to have friendship that's much deeper than that. And that is what the Church of Jesus Christ can offer, is that kind of radical friendship acceptance that will take somebody out to a movie, not because they're your project, because you want to be a friend. Absolutely. Who will invite somebody over to your house and have dinner, you know, with your family, who gives that call that says, hey, how you doing today, you know? That in itself, I think, could change the level of loneliness that most of us, if we would be honest enough, would admit we live with.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I know that there's a term, and I'm not going to be able to think of it right now, but it's about the paternalistic approach to helping people that so often we have as Christians, where, oh, I have my life together, and so I'm going to be your friend so I can help you. No, I don't need that kind of help. In fact, I will push away from that.
It's dehumanizing.
That's
dehumanizing and demeaning.
Yes, it is. And it marginalizes the person you're helping. Yep. And what I really believe that the church has got to learn how to just let people be broken and not need to fix them. You know, Jesus' whole way of coming was to be, like you said, to be our friend, not fix us. In fact, what fixed us was something, the cross, and it doesn't fix us in the way we try to fix each other.
And some of the fixing that I need isn't going to happen until I get to heaven.
Right.
So, you know, thanks for trying, but, you know, God's going to finish that in me when I'm in heaven.
Well, I meant to point that out to you, but I didn't want to go there, but...
Well, there's your moment.
But the problem that so often we all have is we want to look like we're all put together. And the reality is nobody is put together. If you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh, the poor people who have mental illness, trust me, there's things that are much worse than mental illness. There's things, there's difficulties and all kinds of things in life.
Yeah.
But it's not our circumstances, it's what God can do in our circumstances. And I just am thankful. You know, my heart broke the day I heard about Matthew. And I know it was about this time of the year, and so I'm sensitive to that. But I want you to know that my prayer right away was that you would have hope through all of that, that in spite of it, but not run away from it. And you guys are examples to many of us. And you are inspiring hope, and that's why we're thrilled to have you as our guest, our first guest speaker. Now, we are excited to have Josh Wilson along with you here in Omaha. And I don't know if you've ever met Josh, but he's a great young man. Who openly talks about and discusses his battle with anxiety. He has an anxiety disorder. And he and I have spoken about what he experienced in the church as he talks about that openly. But anyway, I want you to know that when you're here, we're going to feed you well. We're going to take good care of you. And we know
I'm saving up all my carbs for some Nebraska potatoes or rice or corn or something.
Yeah, well, corn and beef. You know, you got to have some beef while you're here. But I promise I won't force you to go to a Big Red game. Because we can only be...
Maybe it'll set me free if I did. Maybe it should.
And you know I'm just teasing you about... Yeah, there are things that, until we get to heaven, aren't going to make sense and all of those kinds of things. But in the meantime, we trust and we have hope. And we are people of hope. And so those of you who might be considering going to a support group or something like that, I'd encourage you to think about a Fresh Hope group. We have Fresh Hope group lines, or we have Fresh Hope group meetings online now, and you can sign up for them just by going to freshhopemeeting.com. And I'm going to tell you, those of you who might consider, because you have a diagnosis or whatever, all support groups are not created equally. If you attend a support group that does not have direction or hope as part of it, and it's only a part of venting and complaining or dumping on each other, what's going to happen is you're actually going to get sicker. And the research is proving that now. And so I want to encourage you, if you find a group that is building you up, encouraging you, and challenging you to move forward, even if it's just a half a step forward, you know, I can't begin to tell you the power of that and the power that there is when peers help one another. So consider attending a group online, or there's Grace Alliance groups where Christ is going to be the center, where Jesus is going to be the center of it. There's all kinds of other support groups out there, but the support that we can give to one another is really important. It actually, people who attend support group meetings do better, stay better, and are more open about their own diagnosis usually.
I was going to mention also Celebrate Recovery.
Yes.
Celebrate Recovery started at Saddleback 25 years ago and was started mostly for people hurts, habits, and hang-ups. And not a lot about mental illness in there. And yet, John Baker, I love this man, love this pastor, as we've been talking in the last year and a half, 2 years, understanding how prevalent mental illness is for people who either have a substance abuse, alcohol, or drug addiction as well. And so Celebrate Recovery is in the process of adding conversations and awareness and around mental illness. So people Good. Maybe who are listening, who maybe have a substance abuse and a mental illness, just know that Celebrate Recovery, and you can go to celebraterecovery.com and also find a group maybe in your area that will help you deal with both.
Absolutely, because so many people became addicted because they were medicating a mood or an issue to begin
with.
Absolutely. And there's a lot to be said about the co-occurring or dual diagnosis or whatever words you want to use. But very important. And, you know, those of you who are out there hurting maybe, please, you are not alone. There is no... You don't have to be alone. And even if it's hard to reach out, there's ways to reach out that are safe. And if you're, you know, I'm going to say this. This is not Kay Warren saying this. If you're out there and you're in a church where you don't feel safe at talking about your issues, find a place where you do feel safe to be broken.
Absolutely.
You have to. And you have to find places where it's okay. I encourage you to check out our other podcasts that are available at www.freshhopeformentalhealth@number4or.com, as well as holdingtohope.com, which are podcasts for those who are loved ones and specifically focused. I think we've only got two up there right now. But anyway, thank you so much, Kay, for being with me and taking time out of your end of the week schedule.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to being with you in a few weeks. I really do.
Yeah, and I look forward to seeing you. And tell your husband he should take you someplace really nice to eat tonight.
I will tell him that.
Tell him hi, okay?
I will, Brad. Bless you.
God bless you guys. All right?
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. How did that go?
How do I stop?
Pardon?
How do I stop this?